Welcome to The Virtual Shift, a show looking at the seismic changes happening in healthcare with virtual care at the epicenter. Join me and my guests as we look at key cultural and policy shifts impacting how providers, payers, and patients connect, as well as how care is being reimagined both for today and the future. Hello, and thanks for tuning in today. I'm your host, Tom Foley. You can learn more about this show by visiting the program on healthcarenowradio.com, and be sure to follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at FoleyTom. And the hashtag, The Virtual Shift. I want to welcome my guest to the Virtual Shift, Jason Goldwater. Jason is a senior research scientist at Index Analytics. And Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's great to be here.
Awesome. Jason, you recently co-authored an issue brief entitled Separating Myth from Reality, Telehealth Expansion, and the Potential for Fraud. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that article.
Sure. So I wrote it with two co-authors, Gail Harris, who happens to be my wife as well. And she's was a vice president at the American Institutes of Research. And then Steve Lansonier, who is a research analyst for Impact International. And we put this paper together. I want to say we started the idea brainstorming and writing it a couple of months ago and just released it this past week. And got a really significant response to it, which is wonderful.
Awesome. So tell me a little bit about why this paper. There's a lot of things going on in telehealth, but to talk about the fraud issue, I thought was very interesting. So tell us a little bit about why you focused on the issue of fraud in telehealth.
Right. So my wife and I, Yael and I, have been involved in telehealth for a long time, and Steven has also been involved with it for a few years. And clearly, over the last 12 months, we've seen an explosion in utilization of telehealth services.
And yeah, absolutely.
The pandemic has really brought telehealth to the forefront. I think a lot of us that have been working in this for a while said this is about time. But clearly, people are beginning to understand the utility and value of telehealth. And the policy shifts that were made as a result of the pandemic, which included removing geographic and site of service waivers, expanding the amount of services that were covered under telehealth, allowing audio only to be a telehealth service that was offered, and really sort of removing these barriers of licensure, so allowing providers to deliver services across state lines, really led to this expansion and this overutilization. And now there's a strong discussion about whether or not we should make those waivers permanent and create payment parity between virtual and in-person health, as well as examining the ways of the different telehealth modalities, how those could be used, the types of services that could be covered. And one of the concerns that's being raised as we are all sort of thinking through about how this expansion could continue and how we could remove these barriers is that the propensity for fraud increases. And this is not a new argument. There's always been the discussion, if we use virtual care, there's always the greater possibility of fraud. And clearly it's really started to come more into the light because of this increased utilization and this desire to keep this in place. And subsequently, MedPAC, the Medicare Physician Advisory Committee, or Payment Advisory Committee, I'm sorry, wrote a report as part of their overall recommendations for Medicare that we need to investigate this more thoroughly because there's a greater possibility of fraud and we need to be conscious of that. And as such, we need to sort of incrementally move towards expanding telehealth so that we are really clear about whether fraud will occur or not. And so we decided to put this paper together to sort of show what the evidence is about how much fraud has actually occurred in the telehealth program over the past, decade or so, which has been marginal, no different than any in-person and no different than any other insurance program, and actually quite less, and that there have already been investigations on this, which have shown nothing, and that we need to start, again, sort of separating the myth from what the reality is, that I can understand why people might think there might be more fraud, but the reality is that there's very little chance that's actually going to happen.
Yeah. It reminds me in my patient portal days under Meaningful Use Stage 2, the idea was the elderly would never use it. The elderly don't use smartphones. The elderly don't do this, that, and the other thing. Mm-hmm. And we find that the embrace is just the opposite. And so the same thing is, you know, telehealth is new. Mm-hmm. And before I get into the evidence that you've discovered, let's talk a bit about the definition of telehealth. Obviously, mm-hmm. it can mean a lot of things to a lot of people, video right. only, audio right. only, asynchronous. Can you tell us a little bit about what definition you prescribed to as you sure. were looking at the telehealth fraud issue?
Sure. The definition that we use, I think, when we're doing analysis is the one that the Health Resources and Services Administration, or HRSA for short, came up with many years ago. That is kind of an expansive, comprehensive term, but is not so broad that it encompasses everything. It really just sort of defines, and telehealth is really the use of various modalities to provide care that is not necessarily in person. And that sort of really, I think, spoke to how telehealth is being used right now. That it's really a different number of modalities that are being leveraged by patients and providers for various clinical conditions, from mental and behavioral health to dermatology to ophthalmology to stroke to chronic care management, that there's numerous modalities that are being used. So I think we wanted to really align ourselves with that term, because that's sort of the standard that a lot of other organizations and people use. And also, it sort of encompassed everything that's being done currently.
So getting back to your previous comment, and, you know, the short answer to this analysis is that, you know, there is no finding of fraud that is outside of the norm, if you will. Can you tell us a little bit about your discovery process, what you looked at, and how you came to the determination based on those facts as to there not being any fraud?
Sure. So there were a couple of different approaches that we used. One was sort of this retrospective analysis to look at what the Office of the Inspector General of Health and Human Services had done in the past. And then we also interviewed some programs and that have really seen increases in utilization to see if they had noticed any patterns of fraud in their work that they've been doing over the past couple of years. So, you know, the Inspector General's office has done two investigations of telehealth in 2016 and 2018 and didn't find anything. You know, no incidents of fraud, nothing that was significant enough to warrant a significant policy change or that would needed to be to hinder telehealth, because there was such a great, there were more opportunity for fraud, and that had been shown in their analysis. What they, you know, the most recent analysis they did in 2018 is they took 100 claims of telehealth, and they examined each of them to see if there was any fraudulent behavior. And out of the 100 that they examined, 93 of them were fine. There were 7 of them that had some inappropriate coding or things that were not, that had to be redone. But none of it was malicious. They didn't. Right. It wasn't undertaken with, we want to see how much money we can get out of the Medicare program by, you know, creating fraudulent claims. A lot of them were miscoding, not knowing what was covered, not knowing how to submit the claim. And what they said was there just needed to be more education, and there needed to be coding checks to ensure that the integrity of the claim was correct. Again, things that are done very similarly in both Medicare and Medicaid. Nothing different from telehealth, nothing that was malicious. And in fact, the OIG said unequivocally that the benefits of telehealth are significant. We should not hinder them because of this idea that fraud might occur. When we did some interviews, what we found is that there were almost no instances of fraud. There were very limited instances. Again, nothing malicious. It was not coding correctly, not knowing what to put on the claim form, not knowing everything that was covered, which is understandable. There was such an expansion of services that were covered. And in fact, everyone that we talked to extolled the benefits of telehealth, that no-show rates had dropped by half, that medication management had become so much easier through telehealth, that most people were going to pick up their prescriptions after they had been called in or electronically submitted by a provider they had seen through a telehealth encounter, and that they were able to conduct more comprehensive follow-ups because they were able to schedule them right there in the encounter and then follow up with them through a video conference or some other modality, and that they were able to take better care of their patients as a result. So, you know, they said there are these isolated incidents, you know, none of them are significant, none of them are intentional, but the benefits of this are so substantial that why would we think about stopping this or pausing it or incrementally making changes, because we're concerned about fraud that has not occurred. It's not occurred in years and hasn't occurred in the last year. So what are we so concerned about? I mean, I understand what the perception is, but the reality is very different.
Yeah. I want to read a quote, actually, relative to one of your findings from your paper. It's from the OIG. OIG found the increased utilization of telehealth services yielded significant public benefit to the points that you were just making, and that the continued use and expansion was unlikely to increase costs to the federal payers beyond that what is paid for the same services when provided in person. So I conclude that is, you know, I won't say it doesn't matter, because telehealth is, it has benefits in specific areas. It's not let's replace brick and mortar type of solution. Right. It's an enhanced service. Yeah. It's how do we create this expanded access type of program via the use of telehealth? And you nailed it in the context of, it seems like some of the findings demonstrate that there's better compliance and engagement from the patient in a more virtual setting. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with the idea that, you know, in a brick and mortar facility, 10 minutes in, in and out, and it's more of assembly line care versus true value-based care, if you will, not to abuse the term value-based care, but it seems like the patients like it, the physicians like it, and it is certainly a service, an enhanced service to the overall delivery of care. Would you, what your thoughts on that?
I think that's 100% correct. I think that, you know, it's not, so telehealth is not a panacea for everything, and I would never claim that it is. And you're right, it's not intended to replace in-person care. And I think some of these concerns come from that idea that we're going to go all digital or all virtual. And that's not the case. As I've pointed out a number of times, you can't assess the severity of coronary artery disease in a patient virtually. Like they have to have, you know, magnetic resonance and imaging. They have to, you know, go in and see just how severe it is. And that's going to not be done virtually. That has to be done in person. But telehealth is a complement to in-person care. Telehealth can be used as a means of not having to engage in in-person care unless it's absolutely necessary. And I think when you're talking to a patient who is at home, who is engaging a provider in a comfortable setting through a device where it's very private, you know, I think that there's the opportunity to be more engaged, to be more informed, to have a better communication with the physician, for there to be a better dynamic between the patient and provider. I think that the possibility is there. And I think we've seen that. You don't, you know, you're not going to have a reduction in no-shows if the patient is not feeling comfortable with the process and with the provider. So if so many people are reporting that no-shows are dropping, people are getting their medications, people are taking the pills that they're supposed to be, they're executing their follow-ups as required, you know, that's all coming because there's a level of comfort and trust that's being built through this relationship. That does not mean that we get rid of in-person care. It means that in some cases, you can use telehealth as a primary means. In some cases, you can use it as a complementary means, but it still helps with the overall care of an individual in a way that that it shows that they seem to be very comfortable with and align themselves with, to the point I don't think they want it to go away.
Yeah. You know, we often talk about in healthcare the ability to personalize the experience. And in some ways, having the delivery of care in the home at the convenience to the patient is a way of personalizing it. And I would not have thought that telehealth, well, I would think that telehealth would lead to it, but looking back 5 years and saying, hey, if we did telehealth, you'd have increased compliance and persistence. You'd have better utilization of a physician's calendar, if you will. So, you know, that's compliance and persistence is increased quality of care, putting a patient on a better path to wellness, and not missing your appointment is again a wellness opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think one of the points that you make in the paper is that it will actually reduce costs over time.
It could, I think that the jury's still out on that. Obviously, I think we don't have enough data or analyses to really conclude that it's a cost savings. I think that if you look at in-person care and you look at virtual care, telehealth, you know, I think that the difference in cost potentially may be just marginal. I think that there would be some cost differential, maybe telehealth saves some costs in the end, but I think in the end, inevitably, I think it's just going to bottom out. I think that it's going to be very similar to in-person care. It's just another means of delivery. I think what we have to do, and I think not enough people are doing this, is if you're really going to look at the cost impact of telehealth and it, that by keeping these waivers in, what that's going to do is you have to not look at telehealth versus in-person. You need to look at telehealth versus getting no care. And the pandemic, I think, brought that front and center because so many offices shut down because of the pandemic that had telehealth not been around, and had these waivers not been enacted and these services not been expanded, there are populations that have no ability to get care.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of evidence indicating, like, if you have mental and behavioral health conditions and you are not getting treatment and you're not getting medication, the impact on the cost of healthcare overall and the societal impact is so significant that that's almost a justification for why you want telehealth already, because it provides access to care when access may not be available to significant numbers of populations in this country. So I think that's how you have to sort of analyze that. I think you want to see what the difference would be from in-person to telehealth to create parity, but I think you really need to look at telehealth versus not getting anything.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm going to pause here for a second. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Virtual Shift on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm your host, Tom Foley, and I'm talking to Jason Goldwater from Index Analytics, and we're talking about an issue paper that he originally co-authored entitled Separating the Myth from Reality, Telehealth Expansion and the Potential for Fraud. So you make some conclusions here as to, you know, I always try to, actually you opened up the conversation saying, hey, telehealth was successful in the pandemic because we were quick to change policy, mm-hmm. right? And without it, we would not have we would not have been successful. I'm going to go back 11 years and say we wouldn't even have been successful in the pandemic with telehealth if it hadn't been for the High Tech Act. Because having our records electronically and available mm-hmm. in the cloud versus a server in the office or paper on the paper shelf, we mm-hmm. would never have been successful. So, you know, mm-hmm. this is where government ultimately funds innovation, mm-hmm. in my view, right? Mm-hmm. So they can fund it in many different ways. They can have an appropriation to do X, like we did with high tech and meaningful use, or mm-hmm. we can reduce policy or enhance policies, however mm-hmm. you want to look at that, to mm-hmm. to change the way in which we engage. But you make some five different recommendations relative to I guess different entities and policymakers mm-hmm. on what they should do, what you would suggest they do. Mm-hmm. Can you review each one of them if you don't mind?
Sure.
I can read them off to you if you want.
Off. That'd be good.
In front of me. Policymakers should establish data standards.
Yeah. I think that's kind of been a critical component throughout healthcare. And I think what, you know, we did in the past was we created a data dictionary to sort of help facilitate that process, but it wasn't for a changing of a system. It was for an output file, because there's been no sort of national level analysis that's been done. But, and if we can create those output files, then we can get a much better idea of, you know, what fraud may exist, what possibility of fraud there is, but we can also get a much better understanding of what the cost impact of telehealth is and what the benefits are in terms of providing access to care and effectiveness of care.
So when you say should establish data standards, tell me a little bit more, because I was very much involved in high tech implementation. Mm-hmm. You know, we had the certified documents and things of that nature. So mm-hmm. are you looking to change that or enhance that, or what's missing from that? Is it more of an interoperability challenge?
A little bit of both. I mean, I think the initial thrust was we needed data that we could analyze, and it was just coming in too many different forms, and the ability to sort of work to standardize that data so that we could do some cogent national level analysis was just difficult. So the dictionary was designed so we could standardize those with formats that are not uncommon. These are, you know, I'm not dictating to people to use something that they don't already probably use in other systems, but, you know, we think use ICD codes here, use CPT codes here, use LOINC when you're talking about lab tests or lab orders, you know, things that are fairly common in the output file itself. I think ideally, yes, we would love it if the systems eventually would incorporate sort of a national data set that could then interoperate with an EHR. Now, some of these platforms already do that through the use of an API. You know, they will submit the data from the telehealth platform into a particular electronic health record, but that's not everybody. And again, it's not similar data. So I think right now, I think we're sort of focused on, okay, if you're going to output a file, please do it this way so we can do the analysis. But eventually, yeah, it would be great if these systems could upgrade and to create sort of a national data standard on all encounters, then we wouldn't have to do those output files anymore. And then it would be easier to interoperate with EHRs, with clinical registries, and with other systems.
So do you think if we had those national standards, the next recommendation was payers should consider adopting existing algorithms that are used to identify fraud. But the point there being is, if I, just like claims data, right? I'm from New Jersey. I always say I could go to New York for care, local Central Jersey for care, and Philadelphia for care, right? Three different states. Philadelphia is a city, but three different states, three different HIEs, three different EHRs. No one the only person that really knows me is my payer, because he's going to process the claim. Do you think that the payer should be involved in looking and collecting the clinical data as much as the claims data and doing an algorithm on all the above?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above. And I think the point of that recommendation is there's already, you know, developed algorithms that CMS has used very effectively over many, many years to ensure program integrity and to ensure there is no fraud within the Medicare program, and even to identify areas of waste. And they've used those same for Medicaid as well. So I think what our recommendation was, you don't have to create some massive new algorithm that you've got to test. There are already algorithms in place that could be used on claims to identify whether or not fraudulent activity has occurred. And I think everybody welcomes the use of those, because I don't think they're going to find any more fraud than they would be in any other program. Because as I've emphasized again, this isn't some new form of healthcare. It's not some fantastic creation. It is healthcare delivery just done virtually. So the claim form is going to look the same. The way the patient record will not, we're hoping that changes, but the claim form is going to look very identical to any other claim, except it'll just record it as a virtual visit. And so you can still use the same, I believe, still use the same algorithm to detect whether there's fraud. And they should do that on especially over the last year, to see if any fraud exists before we start jumping to conclusions that, oh, there's a higher risk of this.
So real quick, because we're running out of time. So the last three are: Congress should provide financial resources and personnel necessary to protect the expansion of telehealth from fraud attempts as telehealth becomes a larger part of the healthcare delivery system. Number four was researchers can conduct additional studies that can help them determine the combination of telehealth and in-person care and the impacts on quality and cost. And the last point was public and private payers should analyze the available data on the use of telehealth services in non-rural areas to gain more comprehensive understanding of how telehealth is being used in order to develop insights to tailor fraud, waste, and abuse algorithms. Anything that you would want to add to those last three?
Well, I mean, I think from the last one, you know, telehealth is almost commonly thought of as being used primarily in rural areas. That is not the case, especially now that more companies are incorporating these into insurance plans, so they're available to private audiences as much as they are to rural-based populations. So I think what we were stating there was, rather than focus on rural, you know, focus on these large metropolitan areas that are using telehealth and have been using it extensively over the past year, and determine then whether there is the possibility of fraud, because there's as much of a chance of that occurring there, probably more given the population density, than there would be in rural areas.
Yeah.
I think for the research part of that, you know, one of the reasons why we created the data dictionary was to get standard data to do research on these areas, because there's no national studies of cost impact and access yet. And I think we want to be able to do that kind of analysis to really show the public benefit of utility, understand what the cost impact is, and then determine whether there's any possibility of fraud. And if we see that there's very minimal fraud, does the public benefit of that we've discovered and the cost impact outweigh any potential fraud? And should that then be the way forward on what policy we're going to end up making? And I think, you know, yeah, there should be some expansion of resources, largely because telehealth has sort of been this offshoot for a while until now. And now that it's gotten much more attention, there's greater utilization and there's a desire to extend this into the future. Yeah, I think we all feel comfortable with there should be some resources that do audits and investigations as they would do for any other program. I don't think telehealth needs to shy away from that. I think it should say, yes, the program integrity is critical here. So we do need to have those resources, again, with the possibility that they're not going to find anything. And if they do, it's things that are correctable. I emphasize in all of these investigations and all of these discussions, nothing malicious has happened with respect to telehealth. Nobody is deliberately going out to defraud the government or a payer because of telehealth services. They are either incidental, they're accidental, they're things that can be corrected. And until we uncover that there is massive, significant, intentional fraud, I don't see why we would not continue to enhance and expand the program.
Awesome. Jason, great work.
Thank you so much.
And I want to thank you for participating again to my audience. It's Jason Goldwater, Senior Research Scientist for Index Analytics. The issue brief will be posted on my LinkedIn page, and so folks can find it there. Jason, again, thank you. I want to just really do appreciate your time and energy towards this important topic. And of course, I want to thank the show sponsors, AMD Global Telemedicine and HP. HP Engage Long Lifecycle Products provides the stability, safety, and security you need, plus flexibility and the performance designed for today and tomorrow. If you missed part of today's episode, you can tune in at the same time, 11 a.m. or 11 p.m. Eastern throughout the week. And be sure to check out the program page on healthcarenowradio.com. And remember, connect or follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at Foley Tom, and follow the show's hashtag, The Virtual Shift. I'm Tom Foley. Until the next shift.